the fact that we have sort of resigned ourselves to just clicking OK on anything to access anything is, I would argue, that's not a particularly good thing for civil society.
John Wilbanks graduated from Tulane with a major in philosophy and a minor in French. He had little idea that he would become one of the world's most important forces for good in the areas of citizen science, data sharing, and participant empowerment. We're delighted to welcome this true champion to our show.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Chambers.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Excuse me, but is this an unknown unknown?
I'm not going to say which it is.
Well, we always try to put our guests at ease, John, and so I thought, what would possibly make you feel more at home than Rumsfeld's dulcet tones? So you're welcome. But of course,
thank you so much.
we aim to please. But of course, the real reason for this excerpt is that you actually invoked Rumsfeld's schema when we were talking recently about the tensions between the benefits of broader data sharing and the concerns around it. Concern that you thought actually fell pretty nicely in Rumsfeld's buckets. Do you want to tell us what you meant by that?
Sure. So, you know, I'm part of a group of people who are out advocating for broader access to health information, broader sharing of health information, more reuse of that information. And part of my job at Sage BioNetworks is to think about how do we explain the benefits and the risks of this new world that we're proposing to enter. And it's important to think about how we can even think about those risks. And so Rumsfeld, although I certainly don't share his politics, I think did a fairly nice job of categorizing classes of ways we can think about, you know, either risks or benefits. And a lot of the conversation has been focused on a sort of small set of known and predictable harms or risks, and similarly a small set of known or predictable benefits that we could pull out. But those are basically what Rumsfeld would have called the known knowns. And in my experience in technology and open source over the last 20 years or so, the most interesting cases come out of the unknown unknowns zone. And so it's really important that we be humble both about the risks and the benefits of this stuff by saying that the most impactful uses of aggregated, shared, citizen-generated or donated data are probably not yet known. Because we haven't really thought of them yet. You know, the internet wasn't created to beget email. The web wasn't created to beget eBay. But they were these open systems that allowed for these unexpected uses to emerge. And so a big part of what I try to do is to monitor as many different sources as I can to try to see, you know, are things moving out of the unknown into the known space? And how can we integrate that as rapidly as possible into our strategy, our governance, our work?
So what is one of the knowns that we know now that was unknown to you before that surprises you? How have things evolved on the internet front that really surprise you?
Well, I mean, if we're talking in the health space, we've been engaged in running some of the mobile clinical studies that run on iPhones and use ResearchKit. And one of the things that we know now that we didn't know a year ago is just how much stratification is possible in phenotypes. Just using consumer-grade phones that are out in people's hands with apps that reach into the sensors. I think that people had ideas about that, right? You might have called them known unknowns, right? We knew that we didn't know, but we had a sense of what we were going to learn. But the idea that you could, you know, decompose Parkinson's disease into 25 features and then sort of monitor anyone involved in it based on how they are in those 25 features, that's not something that we knew. And now we do know that. And again, that's sort of part of the grand tradition of in technology when we take something that was designed for one use and then we use it for another thing. You know, most of the stuff that we take for granted in terms of our digital entertainment, consumer culture, you know, these things were sort of originally side effects of the original goals of networks that were built originally for science. So I think there's a fairly nice symmetry to taking these things that were built completely for consumer purposes and bringing them back to science in ways that they weren't designed for.
Wow. So could you, I'm familiar with your with how you got involved in the research kit experience, but could you kind of take us through that story? Because I think it's such an interesting example of how both you and your aspirations and then sort of connected with Apple, with several different universities, and how this became really just an incredibly exciting movement.
Well, I mean, I wasn't part of the original sort of brokering of the relationships between the institutions, so I can't really speak to that. But I had gotten involved with SAGE in 2009 as a board member, as the organization was being formed and sort of emerging out of the Rosetta unit of Merck, as they decided to de-emphasize that. And that came at a moment where I was, in my own career, starting to look at the role of the individual in creating some of these open source community resources that really drive a lot of culture today, like Wikipedia or open source software or some of the other, you know, commonses that were emerging around photography or around text. When I looked at each of them, I sort of saw these parameters where the system, again, wasn't designed to create open source encyclopedias or operating systems, or it wasn't designed to disrupt stock photography. But because everyone had become a photographer, and there was some small percentage of people who really liked sharing their photographs, and all of those people now had like 5 cameras on their person, right, the commons sort of emerges as a carrying effect of the infrastructure and of the individual empowerment. And as we were looking at science, and after years of sort of beating on the institutional structures of science at science commons, I had started to believe that individuals were actually the route, and as opposed to pushing on the institutions, because the incentives are just so messed up for any individual scientist or entrepreneur or, you know, VP at pharma or VP at a health provider. The incentives are just too messed up for passionate individuals to create change. And so as SAGE evolved and my own work evolved, it became clear that one of the routes that was plausible was to begin taking advantage of the fact that we could launch clinical studies with a radically different cost structure than had ever been possible because of the convergence of technologies. That we could use the web, we could use phones to begin going to people directly and asking them for data. And then instead of having to fight to get it out of the system, right, which is sort of like the medical industrial complex, right, and it's so hard to get data out of it, we could just generate it before it ever got there. And then we could actually start building common products out of it and common resources out of it.
Let me just interrupt just to kind of, you know, for the audience, for a couple of points here. I think a lot of this just, you know, is, oh, medical industrial complex. You know, I think that what you were sort of getting at, and I feel some degree of particular affinity and connection, because I was a founding advisor of SAGE when Stephen and Eric started it at the beginning, and because I so deeply resonated with the idea. And what I think the group appreciated long before, like now it almost has become more widely appreciated, is how even though there's this idea that everyone is aligned and the hospitals really care about patients, and that, you know, pharma, maybe that's less of an idea, but that in theory everything is aligned, the reality is that everyone's interests, you know, in practice aren't as aligned with, you know, your interests as a person, as a participant, as a patient participant, as ideally you'd like it to be. And one of the most vivid manifestations of this is you can't get out your data. Is that, you know, the researchers want to monopolize the data, the hospitals want to hang on to your data. That's why there's all these arguments about trying to release from the EMR. And all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, this is an absurd situation where your information is so important, and yet you have such a hard time getting control over it. So I think it's in this context that the efforts from SAGE and that your work in particular comes up. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I mean, I think that despite years of pressure and work from various places to get, you know, EHR data to be a little more liquid, a little more available to the individual that it represents, the reality is we're just not there. And, you know, the research kit studies that we launched in March, you know, the two that we operate have enrolled about 20,000 people in 4 months. The five studies total have enrolled about 70,000 people in that time period. And the data that we're getting off of those studies is really clean, good data. I can speak to the Parkinson's one best. We can really stratify people's symptoms and the features of those symptoms as they manifest on the phone at a really granular level. And it's actually better than data that we could extract from the system. So if you go into a Parkinson's study, one of the things they'll do is they'll test your dyskinesia, your tapping dexterity, by watching you tap on a table, right? And if they're really advanced, they'll count. And, you know, but it's on a phone, you don't just know the total number of taps. You know the mean tapping tap number, the median tapping number. You know the location on the screen. You know whether they floated or not. So you can even dig down into the data and see, you know, if two people said they got a benefit from L-DOPA, you can see that one of them manifests in greater tapping dexterity in terms of the total number of taps, but another one might have manifested by greater accuracy in the circles, right? And that's just one of the kinds of ways you use the sensors to measure the disease. And so it's just remarkable how much more powerful the phenotype is from the phone for this kind of indication than you could get even from a normal kind of clinical visit. Now, that doesn't scale across all indications, but it's just a good example of how far it can go.
So one of the challenges that you had in getting this going, as I recall, and I really feel like this is just one of the most important contributions that I even can think of in recent sort of the whole course of medical research, was the informed consent form and framework that you've developed. So often these forms become essentially a vehicle for hoarding data, and yet you've created, could you just describe what you've created and what your experience was getting it approved at the several different IRBs associated with the Early Research Kit experience?
Sure. So as we were beginning to explore mobile clinical study, and this predates engagement with Research Kit, so this was in early 2014, we were... we knew that we wanted to get into mobile. We knew that we wanted to do Parkinson's in particular because we had some clinicians who had good ways to use the phone. And one of the things that kept coming up again and again was, how are we going to enroll people if we can't look at them and assess whether they're informed or not? We can't explain the forms. And so with some help from the Electronic Data Methods Forum, which is an AHRQ-funded project here in D.C., whose goal it is to collect electronic data methods that are open source that can be given back to the community, we embarked on a fairly long project. We did 20-plus hour-long interviews with the VA, with people who ran outpatient clinics, with bioethicists, with patient advocates, with large-scale EHR vendors. We really tried to talk to a broad universe. Because what we were doing was very similar to what you do in software when you do ethnography before you do interaction and user experience design. And so the big sort of conceptual leap for us was the idea that consent may well be an interface problem as opposed to a law or an ethics problem in terms of informedness, right? You still have to get the law right. You still have to get the ethics right. But the informedness part was an interface problem. And when you hand people a 20-page document that's written not just to inform you about the study, but to cover liability concerns of a large, wealthy research institution, you know, even a clinician might not be able to read the document and extract the essential concepts to communicate. So the idea was, that's sort of problem one. Problem two was that every IRB has its own document, template, form structure that they like. You know, if you ask them, they'll always send it to you, but some places like a 6-page template that's Q&A based, some places like a 23-page template that has, you know, an enormous amount of legal text in it. Everyone wants the jurisdiction of resolution to be in this state of the institution. So it's really hard to standardize the actual legal document because of that. And then the third problem is, those are problems that are consent problems generally, but when you take them onto a phone or a computer, you add to that the problem that no one reads the terms of use. So it's even worse, right? You're taking something that's already...
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've given away my kids and my family and my house on iTunes, but I don't know for sure.
Exactly, yeah. Who knows what's in the iTunes?
And there are numerous examples of people actually doing
exactly.
That, yeah.
Yeah, and at least for a while, there was an anti-nuclear provision in the iTunes terms of service, right? So you can just hide stuff in there because no one's going to read it. So that was sort of the problem set that we had to deal with. And that's why the interface metaphor worked to the extent that it did, and as well as it did, which is to say, you know, for the study that we're going to do, there's like 15 or 16 things that people really need to understand or that we really need to communicate. And then there's maybe five or six that we need to assess and make sure they understand. And those are things like, you know, we're going to use the sensors on the phone to test your disease. We're going to ask you survey questions. It's going to take about 20 minutes a week. We're going to use the data for research. We might share it if you give us permission. You know, we're going to process it. It's going to live in the cloud.
And you explain this so clearly.
Well, so the concept was for each of those essential ideas, each of those essential clinical concepts, we want to have a software style representation of it, because that's what people are used to on their phones. And so we're going to actually communicate this concept in a look and feel that is native to the device that they're seeing it on. So we use icons for things. So there's an icon that represents the clinical concept. There's not a lot of real estate. So we stole the idea of a text slug from journalism, where you have, you know, a one or two word descriptor, and that sits right underneath the icon in giant font. And then underneath the slug is a text label, which is, you know, a 10 to 15 word sentence that further illustrates the concept. So even on that one page, you have three tiers of representation of the concept. And then you have, through a click and a learn more button, you have access to another screen, which covers the clinical concept in detail.
So since I've seen this, I mean, I don't know, Lisa has a question as well, but I mean, just for the audience, it's really interesting because so much of these consent forms are like these, you know, Apple T, you know, terms of service, or, you know, they're absolutely impenetrable and obviously not geared towards informing anybody of anything, but just like ask coverage. But here, this is absolutely incredibly useful, really about people, and it also makes sure that people have access to their data. I know Lisa has a question.
Hey, John, so you wrote recently in your blog that, and this is pretty much a quote, "We blew our chance to build a data world that truly empowers individuals already with consumers' data and surveillance. We screwed it up well and good, but we haven't yet blown that chance with health." Why is that? You talk about how sorry, I did a little research. But you talked about the advantage of data illiquidity in healthcare, how it's made it, you know, thank God for that, because now we can do it right. That's such a sort of a contrarian view. I'm curious about that.
Well, I mean, as we designed all of this consent stuff, you know, I don't pretend to be a consent expert. I've entered the field late, and I've done a ton of reading, and I listen to a lot of folks, but I'm not an expert on it. But, you know, when you look at the reality of consumer, the fact that we have sort of resigned ourselves to just clicking OK on anything to access anything is, I would argue, that's not a particularly good thing for civil society.
Because?
You know, thinking of contracts as something that we just sign isn't particularly healthy. And so the fact that in health that we have regulatory context and ethical context that encourages us to be informed, even if it is observed in the breach as much as the observance, that's actually, I think that's given us an opportunity that is not to be taken lightly. I mean, we actually do have a chance to try to construct something that is both technically amazing and ethically strong. And it would be really hard to reverse engineer ethically strong into consumer culture at this point.
Are all the efforts of the government to promote data liquidity in healthcare to push it forward through meaningful use and all the other stuff, do you wish it would just slow down so you could do it better?
Oh, no, because it's already going so slowly. I mean, the reality is that the providers, as far as I can see, the providers are not in any hurry to move it along. I think they're gonna decrease the number of people who have access to their records from like 5% to 2% in the requirements. So that process is one of the sort of, I think of it like a glacier, right? It's coming, but it's slow, and it's gonna scrape the earth clean when it gets there, but it's just moving really slowly.
They actually were attempting to change that rule of meaningful use from 5% to 1%.
If one person
requested their data at a hospital, they'd met that requirement, although there's a lot of pushback on that too. I have another question, though, which is, you know, maybe my own contrarian position. You know, there's all this effort, and I understand the scientific validity and value of getting data from all of these people to study Parkinson's or whatever, you know, situations there may be. But I wonder, you know, when the natural extension of all that is to build or to create pharmaceuticals or other interventions to help with those diseases, which will create massive amount of profits for whomever invents those and puts them on the market, and none of that financial value flows back to the patients, the consumers that that contributed their data. Should there be a methodology in all this for people to benefit financially also, the way that the big pharma or whoever else will benefit from the data?
It's a fair question. You know, I don't know. I don't want to say yes or no, and I apologize for giving you a wishy-washy answer. I just don't know, you know, because it's really hard to figure out what that benefit would look like. I've been studying it. You know, there's been a fair amount of work on access and benefit sharing for traditional knowledge. So when we go to when a researcher goes to the Amazon, they can't just grab, you know, the route that the indigenous tribes know about and take it and profit on it. They have to give something back, at least in theory. And that's the place where most of the what we call comparables in a venture context seem to exist. And none of them to me are very satisfactory. You know, what we're starting with at Sage is knowledge return. So as opposed to financial return, because we think financial returns are pretty, you know, they're not necessarily that close to like these studies we're doing on stratification, for example. But what we can do is guarantee the return of insights, the return of knowledge, access to the research literature, some visibility into the inner workings of the project if people really want to get their hands into it, as a start for
access. Just as an example of how unusual this is, I was, you know, at this recent conference, Precision Medicine Patient Focused Conference, Zach Gahaney ran in Boston, and they had a lot of patient representatives were talking about participating in clinical studies. In some of the cases, it was in the Undiagnosed Disease Network, where they'd go to Washington, D.C., their kids, you know, trying to figure out what's wrong with them, and they'd have this battery of tests, really just, you know, just incredibly exhaustive for the kid, for the parent, for everybody. And then after they went through this, they're like, okay, well, now, you know, can I take that, you know, they test them for everything. And then, you know, the parents were like, they're subjecting their kid to it, but they're figuring, well, at least I'll get a, you know, report, I'll get, like, you know, whatever, basic lab test. No, they were actually told no, because it's done under a research protocol, you get dick. That was basically the, not almost verbatim, maybe a few words different, but what they got back from the whole thing. So it's actually, believe it or not, this tradition, or this becomes standard to return really minimal stuff to the patient participants.
We're right back to Dr. Van Nostrum and the Seinfeld episode with Elaine and her medical record.
Exactly, exactly. And it's outrageous. And that's what's so, but on the other hand, it's what makes some of the work that John is enabling so important.
It sounds so socialist. Is it socialist?
Yeah, John, are you a socialist? Lisa, who went to Berkeley, wants to know.
No, I'm a good liberal progressive, but I am also I'm a little too pro market to be truly socialist. I mean, the reality is that this is part of incentive design, and so that's not a particularly socialist thing to be thinking about, right? When we think about why do people want to participate in these studies, you know, my belief is that the primary reason is going to be, you know, either to understand something about myself if I'm enrolling in a study so that I can manage my condition or my health better, or to help other people who may come after me or my family, so that they don't have to suffer what I suffer. I think that's probably the number one reason people enroll in these things. Is to get some personal benefit or to benefit the good. The reality is...
Do you risk getting only people who are either really healthy, so they don't care if their data is shared, or who are really sick and are desperate? Do you get that bifurcation? You don't get sort of the rest of the people in the middle to participate?
I think that might be true. I don't know yet. I mean, what we do know from other commons construction spaces is that the ones that stick and the ones that scale are ones where people participate for a really wide variety of incentives. Any system that is building one of these community resources that is dependent on a single resource or small set of resources is vulnerable to those incentives changing. And so you really want a resource that comes from a multiplicity of incentives, because that makes it less capturable and it makes it more sustainable over time. So, you know, I think in the beginning we're going to get people who are, for the most part, sicker that are going to enroll in these kinds of studies and donate the data, either older or sicker, because the benefits aren't yet clear. And to be blunt, we haven't correctly quantified the risks of the existing system. I mean, we're making really significant economic decisions at the FDA on studies that, like, a social media company would laugh at from their sample size perspective, right? I mean, it's almost criminal to me that we make decisions about medicines with sample sizes that would get laughed out of the room at Facebook, right? They would never change something as important as their algorithm for the feed with sample sizes that small, but we're deciding phase three studies.
So are you seeing companies now that are starting to take advantage of this data to make real products? Is it coming out, you know, to the benefit of the patients yet, or are we too far from that?
I don't think so yet. I mean, it may be happening. If it is, I don't know of it. But to go back and finish the question, right? So I think that we are operating right now with sample sizes that are so small that the results are totally skewed. And that's one of the reasons why we have so much trouble predicting if the drug is going to work for person A or person B. And so I'm not convinced that working with, like, the ill or the elderly or the philosophically motivated is going to give us a worse bias than that. My belief is that having the larger numbers is going to offset lots of problems. But this gets back to the idea that I do think that there need to be some financial incentives to get those people in the middle. You know, I bias more towards things like tax credits or you know, the ability to buy into long-term care insurance in a managed pool, as opposed to sort of revenue sharing, just because of how complicated revenue sharing turns out to be in practice. But, you know, one of the metaphors that I like to work with is a land trust. Land trusts are arguably one of the organizational structures that helped create the contemporary environmental movement, because they let groups of people who disagreed about the use of a piece of land come together and manage it together. And in some cases, that's a conservation trust. And in some cases, that's a real estate investment trust, like in Miami. And in most cases, it's just a community land trust. And so if we get to the point where you can have groups of people that have common interests that come together and pool their data, then they can decide if they want to hold out for a paid regime, if they want to take it off the table entirely and have no one ever look at it again, or if they want to work in a collaborative manner to get it developed. And that, to me, is what it feels like is going to scale. It doesn't feel like one big centralized solution is going to scale, because, you know, we're in the data world, in the data health world, some groups are going to be as different as groups in Miami Beach are from groups in, you know, the Pacific Northwest.
It all sounds so rational, and yet I know you come out of D.C. It makes no sense to me.
Oh, I don't work here. I just live here. So,
what do you think is the biggest factor that stands in the way of the vision you're describing? Is it inertia, or are there specific, like, what's changeable in the environment to get from where we are to where you'd like to be?
So there's a couple of things. I mean, I think that we should all be relatively honest and say that for the vast majority of American people, they're unaware of the debate. And so I do not believe that there's, like, a big Nixonian silent majority of people desperate to share their health data.
So do you think Farzad is going to run into trouble where he has this, you know, this whole free the data movement and the idea that everyone's, like, screaming to get their data out? And I'm 100% aligned with the idea of what he's describing, but I worry that most people don't give it, you know, are not, that their people aren't going to start, you know, sort of storming the castle and aren't going to start knocking on the doors, and that they're not, and that it's a little bit of a problem if you're saying everyone's demanding it and then no one actually shows up to demand it.
Well, it's worse than that, I think, the risk is worse than that. Not only do they not demand the data, they don't produce the data, they don't sign up for the studies and numbers enough that matter. To John's point, you know, I think most people just don't care unless they're really sick.
Yeah, and I think that's the number one thing is that you know, most of us are kind of busy, and to the extent that we're going to be able to benefit from what I do think is, so I think Farzad and many others are right that there's a latent desire to do stuff and to participate in stuff with our health data. I actually do think that's out there for some chunk of the population. I just don't think it's going to endure very far beyond being willing to make a couple of clicks, you know. So, but I don't think that there's, like, a silent majority of people who are thinking about this on a day-to-day basis. I think we need to be able to integrate this into people's lives and into their context in a way that it is meaningful. And so, you know, this is why we at Sage, we're sort of focused on studies, because the bias is that the incentives to engage will come from the engagement with an indication, and that the incentive to participate of learning about your condition, learning about your health in ways that you can actually bring back and make some actionable choices, which may or may not, and in most cases may not be related to medicines. You know, one of the things that we're seeing from the Parkinson's study is the number of people whose symptoms quantitatively get worse because they're stressed out by the news.
Well, that's, I think, as I say, that's the big fear of a lot of these diagnostic concepts, right? Is if you tell people you're going to get Alzheimer's, you're going to get Parkinson's, you're going to, you know, that their life goes down, their life quality goes down immeasurably, particularly when there's not much that can be done about it.
Well, but these are the people who've been diagnosed with Parkinson's and were measuring like their tremor and their dyskinesia and their muscle tone and their gait. And we can see that, you know, when they're reporting in the surveys that they're watching the news and the news is stressful, that their symptoms get worse.
Well, that sounds, that's...
And so the intervention with them might be, don't watch the news.
So don't look at the man behind the curtain.
That's the sort of thing that's actually immediately useful to a person. And so, I mean, I tend to think that we're going to accrete, right, the large common public resource by recruiting people with local incentives into studies that reflect those local incentives, and then giving them a relatively simple option to share broadly. Because inside those studies is really valuable. It's already machine digital data. It doesn't need to be translated. It doesn't need to be extracted from Epic. You know, it can immediately flow into a more useful space. But we're not asking people to buy into this abstract incentive. We're asking people to buy into a very specific incentive, which is here's an indication you care about. Here's a study that can return you information that's useful to you. And we don't filter that information back to people. They get a dashboard that shows them like what their data was and what their trends are, and they can look at their answers and begin inferring that, right? I think that's a very powerful incentive to know and to understand one's own self, and that is going to be one of the incentives that helps us get there. I mean, I've signed on to the Get My Data campaign. I believe deeply in it. But there's just so many gigantic, that's where the inertia is the problem, is up in that space, is that, you know, the opportunity cost of extracting the data from that system is so high that only a very small number of people will have the motivation to succeed until there is some systemic change in the technology that lets us one click, you know?
Or such an overt advantage to doing it that people can, as in what you're trying to do, people should be able to appreciate more immediately the benefits of the approach. I know we're running up to the bottom of the half hour here.
It's such a fascinating topic, though, John. Thank you so much for educating us about this today. And it's such an interesting philosophical debate, you know.
I know you've definitely taken our show up several notches. You've actually given us something to think about. Thank you. Thanks so much, John.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.